See, 20 years ago, neither you nor I nor any of us would have imagined that this word, avant-garde, would have dropped out of fashion. I thought that it signified something which was a permanent condition of the visual arts, a permanent condition of thought. Avant-gardeness transcended fashion. Some artists had to be ahead of others. Some artists had to be possessed by the will to push the limits of language, to burst the bonds of convention, and this act of pushing and bursting had to have a kind of metaphorical political dimension. And yet today, this idealistic function of the idea of the avant-garde seems very much depleted. The idea of the artist as revolutionary is seen by most people to be at most a metaphor, and certainly not much better than a myth. The metaphor of revolution is démodé. It went the way of radical chic and cartridge belts on models. It became sales talk in the 60s. It then became a cliché in the 70s, and it died in the age of Reagan. Most of my experience as a critic in the last few years suggests to me that generally those works of art today which preen themselves upon their experimental nature also tend to be fairly trivial. Cultural democracy plus overcrowding plus educational breakdown plus a dying myth of the avant-garde adds up to equal what you see in the East Village when you go to New York. And was the trivialized cult of novelty that hangs over the art world now like smog really what modernism had in mind? No, actually it wasn't. The term avant-garde began as a military metaphor. It meant a small scouting party which went ahead of the main army to reconnoiter and to skirmish. It didn't initiate the decisive action. It did the spying out. And the first man to apply it to the arts was the French social philosopher Saint-Simon back in 1825, who declared that it is we artists who will serve you as an... He was addressing society at large, as it were. It is we artists who will serve you as an avant-garde. When we wish to spread new ideas among men, we inscribe them upon marble or on canvas. What a beautiful destiny for the arts, that of exercising over society a positive power, a truly priestly function, and of marching forcefully in the van of all intellectual faculties. Now, observe that this idea of the social function of the arts is both, in 1825, both new and not new. In one way, it was entirely traditional. It recognized, for instance, that art has always been used as propaganda for religious myth and political ideology. These are the purposes that lie behind every sculpture of Augustus Caesar, every Romanesque tympanum, every medieval stained glass window, every Renaissance bronze of a triumphant condottiere, or every sculpture of the crucified Christ. They were also the purposes conceived for art in France during the lifetime of Saint-Simon, because the French Revolution certainly did not ask for an art that was revolutionary in the modern sense of unbridled subjectivity. Not at all. Like the American Revolution, it wanted classical public declamation based upon Greek and Roman prototypes. For a David in France or a Thomas Jefferson here, neoclassicism was the right kind of visual speech of revolution because it held up models of Roman republican virtue, of plainness, of nobility of thought, and straightness of execution. And in short, Saint-Simon, in talking about an avant-garde, was recognizing what already existed, the power of art to transmit ideas about life. But he was also saying that the artist can help change social thought for the better and so help bring about a better world, that you could, as it were, have Greek culture without Greek slavery. And from this point, one important side of the classical idea of the avant-garde in the 20th century developed, the idea that it is inherently political. It implants radical ideas into the social consensus. Now, Gustave Courbet believed this. He wanted to paint pictures that would change people's views of their own political fate. And from Courbet, the greatest realist painter in France of the 19th century, the same faith proceeds, growing steadily more utopian as it goes on through the work of certain Dadaists and Surrealists, in the work of the De Stael group and people like Mondrian, and of international constructivism generally in the 20th century, and especially in the Russian wing of the constructivist movement before it was crushed by Lenin and Stalin in the 20s. It permeates architectural thinking in the 1920s, and it is at the root of the design ideas of the Bauhaus and of Le Corbusier. If you design a new kind of building, it was felt, if you conceive a new order of city, then in some way a new type and a better type of social being will evolve in harmony with the design. And the avant-garde hope then was that the project of human betterment would provide the moral centre of culture, as religion had provided it before, except that utopian patterns would arise more spontaneously. There was no need to enforce them, as with authoritarian religions, because the utopian believes at their psychic root people prefer clarity to chaos, they prefer virtue to vice. Unfortunately, this turned out not to be true. In terms of the slaughter and suffering wrought in the name of ideology, the 20th century then turned out to be the worst in the entire history of mankind, and the weak, hopeful propositions of art and architecture turned out to be completely powerless against it. Our history shows a very unequal relationship prevailing between art and reality. Another big problem for reformist art was the rise of mass media. In the 16th century, you could imagine painting a fresco that would make a lot of people think a bit differently about politics or about any kind of event, because there were so few competing media and most people couldn't even read. But ours is the century of general literacy, of mass print, as well as radio, television and film, and these media generate heroes and dictate values in a way that painting and sculpture never could. They dominate social discourse in a way that painting no longer can. In the 17th century, when various despotic wastrels from the Pamphili and Barberini families became popes in Rome, they shrewdly engaged Gian Lorenzo Bernini to monumentalise them with such public projects as the great bronze baldacchino in St. Peter's, that enormous affair with the candlestick columns under the dome, and the Fountain of the Four Rivers in Piazza Navona. And these objects were certainly among the most compelling mass spectacles of their day, next to public hangings. But Reagan and Thatcher and Mitterrand do not need to line the streets with bronze effigies of themselves on horseback, because they have television. I think we can reasonably say that in 1986, art really doesn't have any political power, except insofar, and it always has this power, insofar as it can prepare the individual mind for dissent. But no work of art, no painting, as far as I know, ever saved the life of any Vietnamese or any Jew. And yet the hope of improving society through art was only part of the avant-garde project, a long strand of the best art of the last 100 years, and this is the part that I think survives, was woven around the belief that art, instead of being public and hortatory, instead of, sort of getting down into the piazza or the agora or the forum and taking people by the scruff of the moral neck and shaking them, that art, in fact, ought to be solitary and hierarchical and rather difficult and, dreaded word, elitist. For our purposes, this strand begins with Edouard Manet, as the other one does with Gustave Courbet. It begins with realism, but with an expository and not a didactic kind of realism. Its model, as invoked by the great French novelist Gustave Flaubert, was the objectivity of scientific thought, you know, the detachment that the scientist claims in studying the world, rather than the metaphor of scientific experiment, per se. And its aim was to produce a perfectly limpid, perfectly clear, non-judgmental kind of art, the mirror of the world. It didn't aim to show things as they might be, but as they actually were. There was everything in common between, you know, I mean, if you read Flaubert's novel Madame Bovary, which is about the life of a deluded middle-class woman living in a provincial part of France, you know, and her romantic fantasies and how eventually they turn into a kind of fatal reality, there is everything in common between the sort of relentless detail in which the boredom and pointlessness of Emma Bovary's life is built up by Flaubert, sentence by sentence, and the view of Paris life that is taken in paint by Manet, and both, in a sense, point forward to that peculiar kind of systematic vision in which Georges Seurat assembles his figures on the speckled lawn of the Grand Jatte in the masterpiece of pointillism in Chicago. The common thread is that in a state of detachment, art contemplates its own nature as language without the hope of changing the world. The perfect realization of feeling, as Cézanne knew and said, was enough for a life's work. The quest for formal perfection and the stripping away of incrustations from visual speech are enough. And as a result, a lot of modern art looked esoteric because it was esoteric. I mean, Cubism was not meant to be easy. That, when you look at a Cubist picture and you see that quick shuttle of multiple viewpoints and that play between solids and transparency and its odd tensions between contradictions and, you know, the way you get signs and letters and numbers, very clear things on one hand and extreme painterly ambiguity on the other, you know, in that brown soup. These things are hard to figure, you know, they're hard to read, and they demand the kind of sympathetic attention that basically very few people are prepared to give an unfamiliar picture at first. Before 1880, the idea that every work of art talks to its own history, and that this conversation with its own history is part of its meaning, was taken more or less for granted. I mean, every informed viewer looking at a Rubens knew when he was quoting Titian, let's say. But with modernism, this procedure of quotation and historical reflection moved very much to the foreground. It had a big influence on ideas of what was and what wasn't advanced. I mean, the best modern art, some of it, was also profoundly historicist. I mean, you think of Manet and his relation to Velázquez, you know, dead for 200 years before Manet took up a brush, or you think of Picasso and his relation to archaeology and to Mediterranean classicism. But above all, advanced art claimed the right to be solitary. It claimed the right to a small audience, not the big mass audience of the salons. And in this way, it claimed the same kind of rights as the sciences which Flaubert had praised as a literary model, and especially the right not to be understood too soon and not to be understood by too many people. Unpopularity gave the new work a chance to kind of develop its resonances before it could face the full stress of public consumption. However, painting is not like science. I mean, painting does not improve from decade to decade, or from century to century, in the way that our knowledge of stars or of genes does. In art, there isn't any progress. And nobody living today can paint or draw as well as Velázquez or Rembrandt. And John Donne was not the larval stage, let us say, of Erica Jong. On the other hand, not even the greatest doctor in the 17th century knew as much about the fabric of the human body as a third-year medical student does in 1986. In the arts, we move in cycles. We are watched by the unwearying tribunal of the great dead. We can just hope not to bore them. These people live in their works, and there is no appeal from their judgment, which is nevertheless silent. You know, it is Palladio who judges the Neo-Palladian, and not vice versa, as some people now think. We have also to beware of those military metaphors that lurk in the, you know, in the thickets of late modernist discourse, you know, confrontation, engagement, conquest, attack, assault, blah, blah, blah. Such language tends to induce a mood of hypnotized conformity and self-importance. I mean, the French poet Baudelaire saw this when he remarked that, quote, "these habits of military metaphor indicate a spirit which is not militant, but actually made for discipline." And the lingo of confrontation had a big appeal to critics, especially to French and American critics, because it made them feel tough. And also it provided a cheap scheme for teaching art history. And hence, you know, among other things, that stereotype that you often hear, that American abstract expressionism was the climax of a series of avant-garde assaults upon the academy that had played themselves out in Europe. And hence also the awful habit from which we're still not free of presenting the history of modernism not as the complicated grid of interlocking motives that it actually is, but rather as a kind of battle of heroes, you know, a simple succession of attack waves, each one going further up the beach, you know, to attack the past or the academy or the reactionaries or whatever it is you want to call them. You know, first of all, there come the impressionists and then the fauves and then the cubists and then the constructivists and then the dadaists and the expressionists and then the surrealists and all, you know, sort of storming heroically ashore to attack the entrenched academy like, you know, attacking the Japanese at Tarawa, until finally the American landing craft come rolling in through the surf and the ramps splash down and out come Jackson and Bill and Barney and Clifford and Bob blasting their way up the sand. And then suddenly the beach is silent, the war is over, there is no more academy, and the mopping up turns to colonization as Roy Lichtenstein and Klaus Oldenburg and Andy Warhol start converting the old academical bunkers and emplacements into drive-ins and McDonald's stands. You know, this is the kind of scenario that art fans love. And of course it's a travesty of Earth history. You know, I think one of the reasons for our sense of cultural glut is that America, in its immense generosity, learnt to love art too much. Europe was always much more hostile to it. And especially America fell in love with the idea of an avant-garde. Everything in its industrial heart, actually, was straining towards that moment of cultural union with the new. The paradox was that America, as a result, really had no avant-garde, at least not in the original sense of the term. I mean, Europe resisted change, but America generously embraced it because America is addicted to progress. Its cultural industry, in fact, is announcing fresh, unnerving changes in the body aesthetic which telescope the future into the present. And so the central idea of the European avant-garde, which was that new art could only change society by challenging it, had the utmost difficulty in taking root here. It could only sort of do so after, particularly after, I mean, let's say after 1960, it could only do so as a kind of fiction supported by elaborate tales of cultural martyrdom. I mean, by the end of the 1950s, the idea of the advanced artist as transcendent victim was fixed in popular culture anyhow. I mean, you think of Kirk Douglas cutting off his ear, you know, in The Agony and the Ecstasy, or Charlton Heston wrestling with the Sistine ceiling. And under these circumstances, what American could really sustain his fear of that bogeyman of the of European modernism, the Academy? And the Academy was never powerful here. The power of tradition to wither new ideas in the bud after 1960 particularly was quite slight, because unlike Europeans, Americans did not fear the future. And here, however, avant-gardism was defused by embracing a more business-like model of novelty and diversity, of the fast obsolescence of products and the conquest of new markets, new cultural markets, I mean. In the 50s and 60s, because there were fewer producers and consumers in the cultural economy, Fewer artists, fewer collectors, fewer museums, fewer endowments. The differences here from the classical European avant-garde as it existed between 1900 and 1930 might not have been so evident, though they certainly became so with the advent of pop art in the 1960s. But if the ambitions, let's say, of a Mondrian were deflationary and reductive, the American notion of avant-garde activity is now competitive and inflationary. And moreover, just as, you know, the dark side of Romanticism in America, you know, there's no American Goya, there's no American Jericho, there's the dark side of 19th century Romanticism here was, as it were, repressed by moral, enlightened by moral earnestness. In the same way, the anguish of the European avant-garde in the 20th century, the anguish of an Artaud or a Max Beckmann, became transformed into the now very popular idea of art as a kind of therapy. And this sanctification, this therapeutic sanctification of the new, really took hold after about 1950, when the values that had been propagated by the Museum of Modern Art, the idea basically that new art benefits the viewer by giving him or her access to deeper and more instinctual and more freely creative drives, when these values began to permeate the educational system of this country. The European opposition between artist and audience, which had always been a very important part of the contract between the artist and the people he was addressing, this opposition now seemed quite outmoded. I mean, not only was art good for you, not only was it therapeutic, but it seemed that just about everybody could be an artist. You know, you put a kiln. I mean, this Joan Mondale's notion of social utopia was to place a kiln in every suburban backyard so that we could combat our anxieties by making raku egg cups. I mean, I've always wondered where Judy Chicago got the volunteers to help make all that dreadful gynecological Tupperware. Until I read a recent survey, the results of a recent survey conducted, I think, by the National Endowment for the Arts, which suggested that 40% of the population of the US is engaged in some way or other in what are loosely termed art and craft activities. Now, that is 100 million people. I mean, that's it's a barely credible statistic. See, there are no cottage industries anymore. If this frightening statistic is true, then, of course, Cap Weinberger could fix all our defence problems tomorrow by mobilising this creative proletariat and bombarding the Reds with Bargello work and Appalachian baskets and pottery frogs and until they get down on their knees and cry, "Uncle." In addition to that, there are now more than a million millionaires in the United States. Now, I'm told that $1 million isn't what it used to be, but I still find this statistic pretty curious because, you know, how do the members of this mighty horde distinguish themselves from one another? Well, art, you know, very largely with art. I mean, once the millionaire would go to Africa toting his .30-06 and he'd come back with stuffed antelopes and things for the den. And also leopard skins for the wife. But now wildlife is diminishing, and so today they go to Soho and to the East Village, and they fill their dens with florid objets by people like Jed Garrett or Keith Haring or Rodney Allen Greenblatt. These trophies are, unlike the skins of the violated animals, a renewable resource. They are poor art for rich people. And to collect them is an ecologically responsible act. Thanks to the growth of art collectors and art fans, Soho and the East Village have now become, as I know Soho, I've lived there for 15 years, before it was even called Soho. It used to be empty at night, it was wonderful. They've now become, to the tradition, you know, of the avant-garde, as it were, what Safari Land is to Kenya, or what Parrot Jungle in Florida is to the Amazon. They're not so much places as rides. And in the process, the old distinction between avant-garde and kitsch has largely evaporated. Today we have an art world which produces different products for specific audiences, rather like the record industry. And one of its main products is avant-garde kitsch. High art kitsch is now a very considerable cultural industry, part of the story of postmodernism. The movement of reputation in the 80s is now, has become, you know, in contrast to the slower, more gradual, more difficult, and in some ways more dignified form that it had, let's say, in the 1950s or 60s, it's become like a succession of stampedes sparked by the fear of missing out on a hot name. And collectors learn to spurn absolutely nothing that comes with credentials, no matter how flashy or how slight it might look, for fear that posterity might sneer at them for missing out on them. Ah, you're the guy who ignored Van Gogh when he was alive, you know. The slight delay in reaction time between the apparition on the wall and the production of the checkbook is covered by the word interesting. Four bland syllables which are, in fact, highly coded. The earlier word used to be quality, whose utterance was meant to mark off a given artwork from the swarm of others and confirm the precision of a collector's taste. But interesting has the opposite effect. It tends to suspend judgment and to cover the rear and defend the vacuum cleaner habits of a cultural mass market without any precedent that I know of in art history. It states with a sort of coy defiance that buying this thing may not be a mistake, even though its owner does not know what to say about it yet. And it acknowledges that by the time thoughtful aesthetic judgment is passed, which may be a fairly distant prospect given the promotional state of too much American art criticism, the price will have trebled, the boat will have sailed, the artist will have turned 31. And it is now time to speak of contemporary masterpieces, a code word which means formerly interesting art, which after 4 years carries a $20,000 to $50,000 price tag. And in the meantime, it is common for not a few artists to assume that they will have 5 or 6 hot years before they pass out of fashion. And some of them are undoubtedly right. Nothing could be more difficult for those processes of slow maturation, steady reflection and internalization and thought which govern any serious career in the visual arts. There are signs, in fact, that we're heading for a nasty crash in some areas of the recent contemporary market, though, of course, by no means all of them. More and more, it's the market as cultural spectacle which masquerades as the common center which late modernism has lost. Our idea of high culture is very fragmented. It's been pecked into fragments by the rate at which it's consumed and then reassembled in artificial monuments called museums. And this is the museum age, and I've nothing against museums, but nevertheless we have to realise that they do have a certain kind of excess monumentalising effect on the nature of taste. All new art becomes potential museum art, and all new collections, thanks to the tax laws which underwrite the spending spree we have at the moment, are potential museum collections.